This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, a look at how just a few degrees of warming is rewiring the food chain in the Arctic. But first, in 2008, the Inupiaq village of Kivalina, Alaska, sued 24 of the world's biggest fossil fuel companies. Villagers charged ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, and others with destroying their home, a seven-mile-long barrier island in Alaska's Chukchi Sea. Scientists estimate that due to climate change, Kivalina will be underwater by 2025. This week, Kivalina's legal battle finally came to an end. The Supreme Court had declined to hear their case in 2013, and this week the village declared it will not file a claim in state court. Meanwhile, the water there continues to rise, the storms get stronger, the ice gets thinner, and Kivalina's 400 residents must grapple with how to relocate in a decade they're estimated to have left. If you want to give us a call, our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. If you're on Twitter, tweet us at SciFry. Joining me now to discuss the impact of climate change on Kivalina is Kivalina City Council member Colleen Swan. She joins us from there today, where, by the way, it is 13 degrees warmer or so than it is here in New York City. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome in Christine Shearer, who wrote about Kivalina's legal case in her book, Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. She's also program manager for Coal Swarm. She joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, Christine, maybe you can give us a sense of where exactly Kivalina is in the world.
Kivalina is in the northwest of Alaska, above the Arctic Circle. It's a bit remote, so just to give a sense to the listeners out there, when I traveled there from California, I went to Anchorage, and from there I took another plane to a town called Kotzebue, and from there I took a cargo plane to Kivalina. And before boarding the cargo plane, they did ask me my weight, so it was a little plane. And Kivalina is on a very thin barrier reef island between the Chukchi Sea and the Kivalina Lagoon.
Colleen, tell us about the people who live there and what they do.
The people of Kivalina rely mostly on what the environment, what the land provides for in terms of food, and basically it's been our way to make a living for hundreds of years. So whatever the ocean, you know, especially the ocean, during the winter months, the ice is part of our landscape because we go out there and we set up camps and hunt. And it's all seasonal. So we were able to see the changes years ago.
Mm-hmm. Christine, tell us more about why the island is disappearing. What exactly is happening to it?
Well, because of global warming from greenhouse gas emissions, the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the global average. And so sea ice is forming on the coastline later and later in the year. And the lack of sea ice is making the island vulnerable to erosion from storms that occur pretty regularly in the fall. And on top of that, the lack of sea ice means there's more heat in the water, in the air, to increase the power of the storms when they hit the island. And so that's contributing to erosion.
And Colleen, you have said that you've seen these changes for years. When was your first clue that things really were different there?
During the bearded seal hunting season, which happens in May, June, and July, the men go out hunting while there is still ice out there because the seal obviously need to have a resting place. All sea mammals do, who, you know, like the seals and the bear, the polar bears. And so we have, every year we cut up the bearded seal, dry them up, store them for the winter, and that provides a winter supply, and that's what keeps us warm in the Arctic. So at first, like maybe about 15 years ago, the season started 2 weeks early. And we didn't notice at first the gradual change until it became 2 weeks early, consistently from year to year, and now it's at a point where we can't really tell. So our people, our hunters, remain vigilant. You keep an eye on things. That's what our hunters do. They keep an eye on the weather, on the ice, on the seasons, because if we don't, we miss the season. So we've seen a lot of changes over the years. The hardest one to swallow was the fact that our ice wasn't safe anymore for us to set up whaling camps.
The ice isn't safe, but then also the worry about the impact of these storms and sea level rise. How big an impact has that been?
You know, our people, we just had a minor storm last fall, and I'm one of the first responders if anything goes wrong, so I keep an eye on things too. And when we got that storm last fall, I decided I'm just going to go to sleep. I'm tired of worrying. You know, I want to get some rest. And the next morning when I woke up, I saw the impacts from a minor storm and how quickly, as the storm started to go away, how quickly the water rose, and realized, you know, that was a very dangerous thing for me to do, to sleep, to not, you know, to not face the reality of that night. And, you know, that's I realized this is what climate deniers do, not us. Not us who face the reality every day. We wake up to it. There was never a debate for the people of Kivalina. So we just wake up to it every morning. We depend on what the landscape, the ocean, everything provides for us.
We
are very familiar with.
We're talking with Colleen Squan from Kivalina, Alaska today. It is a small town in Alaska that faces the prospect of being underwater as soon as 2025. We're also speaking with Christine Scheer, who wrote a book about Kivalina. And this lawsuit, Christine, that we mentioned earlier, maybe you can talk about the basis for that 2008 lawsuit, which now it seems has gone nowhere. Tell us a little bit more about what the villagers were looking for and why this legal battle came to an end.
Sure. In 2008, Kivalina filed a legal claim against 24 fossil fuel companies for public nuisance, which is unreasonable harm. And they charged them for being amongst the world's largest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. And what they were seeking was damages, their needed relocation, because by that point, several government reports had stated that Kivalina needed to be relocated due to climate change. And so they were seeking their relocation costs. And then they charged a smaller subset of the companies with conspiracy and concert of action for attempting to create a false debate around climate change science. And in their lawsuit, they cited internal documents from companies showing that they had funded studies not to improve the science of climate change, but to deliberately create doubt and confusion about the issue. And in doing that, they took a playbook straight out of tobacco.
Hmm. Colleen, your village originally voted to relocate as far back as 1992. Is it just cost? Is that why this hasn't happened yet?
Yes, it is mainly cost because of the comparison to the sea level. So there's worry that it is flood prone, the site that the people selected, but it's not. The history goes way back. Our people's knowledge goes way back, hundreds of years.
Are you looking for help from the federal government? We understand that the Secretary of the Interior visited Kivalina earlier this week. What was the visit about, and what did you hope would come out of it?
The visit was mainly about getting information from hunters and elders about the environment. And her visit was very timely because of the reason why our case got thrown out of court, because they said this was a political question, and so we have no choice but to go back to the government. And they, you know, whenever we bring up relocation or climate change and ask where do we go to talk about this with the government, and the reply always is, you know, there's no agency set up to address those two questions.
And Christine, talk more about that. I mean, what kind of structure is in place for a community like this facing this issue? Where do they get help?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. So for disaster management, most of the policies are around after a disaster occurs and a disaster declaration is made that releases some funding. And then it's usually to help a community relocate where they already are at. But with the community like Kivalina, they need to be moved, they need to be relocated. And we don't really have the policies in place to relocate a community, and we don't have a federal agency in charge of that. And so it's really fallen on the people of Kivalina and other Alaska Natives in a similar situation to try to put that together themselves. And, you know, that's quite a task. And so, if anything, I hope the visit of the from the Interior Secretary helps put that into motion, starts making this happen. We need that in terms of climate adaptation policies.
Colleen, we have just a moment left, but I wonder if your village had to move, would things be much better elsewhere? I mean, all of your region there is changing so fast.
You know, I asked the same question about 10 years ago, because Alaska is about 70% wetland, and, you know, the probably the best place to move to would be on top of a mountain, but that can't be done. So you build up the ground with a gravel pad, and that was our intent, but the cost is very high. And then the permafrost is melting, so there would have to be special consideration given to that to make sure that whatever gravel pad you put doesn't melt the permafrost.
Christine Scheer, do you see other instances of towns like this? And could another lawsuit like this potentially bring attention to communities like Kivalina?
I think in terms of climate change, inevitably the damages are going to keep increasing. More communities, more cities, more states, more tribes are going to have to deal with trying to help people who are being affected by climate change. I think more lawsuits will be filed. And I think it might get to a point where fossil fuel companies might find it's less costly to settle than to keep fighting these lawsuits.
Christine Scheer is author of Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to Colleen Swan, Kivalina's relocation coordinator and a member of the city council there. You can find photos of Kivalina at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/Alaska. Coming up, more impacts from climate change in a place even further north in Alaska. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankowski. Down here in the lower 48, if the temperatures heat up a few degrees, do you really feel it? If New York springtime temperatures go from, say, 71 to 73 degrees, it doesn't really change your wardrobe much. But up in the Arctic, those few degrees can entirely restructure an ecosystem based around that all-important temperature of 32 degrees Fahrenheit. The ice, which forms shelves for seals, feeding zones for fish, hunting areas for bears, can disappear one season to the next. Springtime snow showers can turn into frigid rain and set the stage for climate change winners and losers. My next guests have been working with wildlife for decades in the Alaskan Arctic, and they've seen some of those changes firsthand. Cheryl Rosa is a wildlife veterinarian and biologist and deputy director of the United States Arctic Research Commission in Anchorage, Alaska. She joins us from Alaska Public Media today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Rosa.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
And George Dvoke is an ornithologist and director of Friends of Cooper Island, based in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Dvoke.
Hello, John.
If you want to give us a call, our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can always tweet us at SciFry. George Dvoke, I'd like to go to you first. You've been working up in the Arctic for like 40 years now, and you make camp at a place called Cooper Island. Can you explain exactly where this is and what it's like there?
Cooper Island is a small island 20 miles east of Point Barrow, and I went there in 1975 because I found a small colony of seabirds that I started studying, and because seabirds are long-lived birds, I kept the study going so I could look at their lifetime success, and I have kept the study going for 40 years as a result. It started off just as a bird study and became a climate change study because of climate change so rapidly in the past 15 years.
Explain some of the things that you've seen change up where you camp over these 40 years.
Well, sea ice used to be just offshore from the island. Birds would go out to the ice edge and find fish under the ice. There's a species of fish they eat that is found very close to the ice. And birds did very well on the island, raising two chicks every year per nest for 28 years. And then in 2003, the ice started to retreat rather rapidly, and suddenly the birds were having a very tough time finding any prey at all. And as a result, the breeding success dropped greatly. Tied into that, though, was the fact that the polar bears were losing the ice platform that they walk on, and they had to go someplace, so they came to Cooper Island, and they started eating the chicks that I was studying. So there was a whole realm of climate change impacts I was seeing on this one seabird colony.
And just to be clear, when you say that the ice retreated, it didn't just retreat a little bit offshore of where it was, but miles and miles away.
Yes. Sea ice used to be very, very close. And I actually drank sea ice, multi-year sea ice. That was my source of fresh water for the first almost 3 decades of the study. Now the ice retreats on average around 400 miles offshore and as far as 600 miles. So that the whole nearshore area just north of the island has changed drastically. And most importantly, or certainly as important as the ice retreating, is the fact that the ocean now is absorbing all that solar radiation, so that the sea surface temperature has gone from being very close to zero to being 3 to 4 to 5 degrees. And that has changed the whole fish composition of the area.
My goodness, so much that you've seen over these years. We'll get back to more of this. I want to go to Dr. Rosen. You're Deputy Director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Is it your job to tell President Obama what's happening up there?
Well, maybe not my job, but we work together to come up with some recommendations for both the Office of the President and for Congress on what research should be done and how funding should be spent on Arctic research. And climate change is a huge part of that.
And obviously, you've got a lot of people working up there, but what do you think when you hear George's stories?
It's a great way to illustrate what's going on. I mean, the fact that he has this long-term research, because long-term research like that, because it's so hard to fund year after year research. We tend to fund research in 3 to 5 year chunks, and to have a 40-year data set is really rare and extremely valuable. So it tells an incredible story, and it illustrates in a really succinct way why that research is important, why that type of research is important, and those impacts.
Now, we talked to Michael Castellini of the University of Alaska Fairbanks earlier this week. He had an interesting analogy for some of the changes that animals are facing up in the Arctic today.
You know, animals have adapted in the past. They've adapted to past ice ages. The problem is, in this particular case, though, is that rate of change is very, very slow compared to what's happening now. So it's as if the asteroid, you know, hit again, but now instead of having thousands and thousands of years for animals to adapt, you're trying to force it into about 150. And that's not within evolutionary time scale. That's way too fast.
Dr. Rosa, could you comment on that idea?
Absolutely. And that's really the crux of it, is this change. There have been changes in the past. The rate of change right now is extremely rapid, and the impacts on disease, phenology, and other types of things like primary production and biodiversity in the Arctic, we're seeing some things directly. We suspect other things are going to be happening, so we're studying now, doing research to try to be able to track these changes that we think may happen if they haven't happened yet. But it's absolutely phenology is the study of the relationship between climate and these periodic biological phenomena like migration or the time that plants flower. And as slow evolution happens, prey and hosts and predators and those types of things, they evolve together. So a good example is to look at something like caribou, and they have very specific times that they migrate, and it's photoperiod, or the sunlight is something that cues that in. Well, if you get warming and the snow melts earlier and the plants begin to bloom earlier, as they are right now, sometimes up to 2 weeks or more earlier than they have normally in the past, you may have caribou arriving with calves at times that you don't have that peak plant production, or the plants aren't at their peak nutrition. And that has been shown to cause a decrease in calf survivability. And that kind of thing, when you see things like massive decreases in body condition or a decline in calf production, those are the types of impacts that are going to have a ripple out effect, a larger effect on the greater population.
Dr. DeVoque, I'd like to get your thoughts on what we heard from Michael Castellini, this idea, this compressed time frame where we're expecting the animal life there to adapt so quickly to changes that are happening far too rapidly.
Yes, I think, and what Cheryl said is a very good point, that the ecosystems kind of used to evolve together as things changed. And one of the things that's happening now is that the Arctic prey is being pulled away from my seabird colony, and the subarctic species haven't had time to move up there to take the place. And in the past, when you had these ecosystem shifts, you actually had a shift of an ecosystem, but here you have things that are impacting various species in different ways. And what I'm seeing with my birds is that there are some individuals that can cope with an ice-free area and raise young, but it is a very small subset, and whether they can then keep that population present while all of the truly Arctic-adapted individuals are not successful is something I'm going to find out.
We're talking with George Devoke, who's an ornithologist and director of the Friends of Cooper Island, and Cheryl Rosa, who's a wildlife veterinarian and biologist and deputy director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission in Anchorage. We're talking about some of the effects of climate change. And if you're seeing some of those effects yourself or you have, give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Let's go to George, who's calling from Minnesota today. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind, George?
Well, I want to second everything I've heard on the program so far today. In 1968, I began flying in the far north, seaplanes, northern Canada and Alaska, for the next 38 summers, and I've seen all these changes that they are talking about. Let me give you some examples. When I first started in 68, the ice out dates along the ice Arctic Circle began about late July. Now it's 2 to 3 weeks earlier. And I flew a lot in the Hudson Bay area. And there, the polar bears are coming off the ice like 10 to 15% lighter. And with the ice pack shrinking and leaving earlier, some of them are drowning because they're not able to get to swim that huge distance back to shore.
Hmm.
Two more things. In 1940 to 42, a tiny ship called the St. Rock became the first ship to navigate the Northwest Passage, and it took it 27 months. That's the first ship ever. But in 2000, an updated version, the St. Rock II, made that passage in less than 2 months, and that's what stops along the way. That's a huge example of what the difference is in the ice conditions in the Arctic.
My goodness,
addition,
but George.
Wasps and,
yeah, well, I'm just gonna let you go just because I want to get a quick comment from Cheryl Rosa. But thank you so much for sharing your story, because you just like our other guests have seen this firsthand. And Cheryl Rosa, obviously, we've heard a lot of these stories. I wanted to get to one thing quickly about, you know, we hear so much about melting sea ice in some of these stories, but another side of this is snow showers in the area turning to rain, and that also affects life in the Arctic, something we don't hear as much about as retreating sea ice.
Right, exactly. That season, the transitional season in the springtime, especially when normally things like seals may be on the ice, but the pups themselves are in what's called lanugo. It's kind of like a fluffy fur. It's not a good waterproof fur. It's made for cold insulation, keep these guys warm in cold, dry conditions. And when they get rained on in this lanugo, they get wet. And that is something that is not a good thing for a brand new pup. Similarly, there have been some studies that have been done looking at peregrine falcons that are cliff nesters. Typically, they're pretty much they're open cliff nesters where you'll have chicks that will be born, and normally they will be cold enough weather that, you know, during the really the time that they're really vulnerable, they'll be in their kind of downy feather condition, and they'll stay warm. Instead, we're having these earlier and earlier rains instead of snow and icing events that is having a pretty severe effect. They've done some studies looking at the putting covers or nest box over some of these nests, and those chicks do much better when they don't get wet and get cold.
Mm. Our caller George mentioned polar bears that he's seen over the years, and I know, Cheryl, you've done autopsies on polar bears. What have you seen?
You know, it's a tough one to interpret. We know that with the ice-free days, as the number of ice-free days that George was talking about, as they increase, there have been studies that have shown that there is decreased female survival and breeding rates, and also there's decreased cub survival and body condition changes. And some of the necropsies that I've done on polar bears, including one on Cooper Island with George, have shown polar bears that have come in extremely poor body condition, very, very emaciated, and have not revealed other reasons for these deaths. So we don't have a specific direct connection, but it is highly suggestive that these animals are not able to get the food that they're eating, that they need to keep good body condition. Also, they may be expending more energy to because they have to swim more to try to find their prey. It's hard to make direct connections, and a lot of the impacts that we see are regional in terms of climate change. But it's highly suggestive that these guys are suffering these effects.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. And we're talking about impacts of climate change in the Arctic. George Dvoki, I've read different things about cod up in the Arctic. You hear sometimes about booming populations in Norway and Russia, less optimistic things about cod in Alaska. What's the story of cod up there?
Well, Arctic cod are actually a rather small forage fish. They're 6 to 8 inches long, and they're not harvested commercially in the Western Arctic at all, so that no one has really paid much time or attention to them. So we don't really even know what populations were like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but now that work is being done, it's clear that they are a cold water fish. They don't like water that is more than 4 degrees Celsius, and they certainly like areas with ice cover. So they have shifted away from the areas that are opening up, and some of the work that I've been doing with my seabird species has clearly shown that, because seabirds will do anything they can to find cod while they're feeding their young, and they in certain years can't find any cod at all. There is a possibility, and certainly this is one of the things that happens. It's true with the bowhead whales that are studied by Craig George up there. He has found that the ice melt has helped the bowheads a bit, because there was a bit too much ice for the bowhead population, and now it's actually having an increase. And guillemots also probably prospered from things warming up a bit in the 70s. But so that cod populations elsewhere may have been doing better at a certain point, but once you get this sea surface temperature rising as it is, they won't be doing better for long.
But Cheryl, another thing that we've seen is the possibility that orcas, killer whales, are moving farther north now, and those bowhead whales that are more common might be food for north traveling orcas?
Right. Sue Moore has written several papers and done some presentations that really break it down really, really well into, if you look at Arctic marine mammals in three groups, you have the ice obligate or the animals like the polar bear, the walrus, the ring seal, and bearded seal that absolutely depend on ice. They are ice obligate animals. Then we've got the ice-associated marine mammals like the bowhead whales and the beluga. But then you've got these seasonal migrants, and those killer whales are orcas, along with things like gray whales and other types of whales that come up on a seasonal basis. Are really able to potentially take advantage of a situation and not only provide almost a competition in certain cases for resources, but also a threat because, you know, obviously orcas, they've come to the north before. They're not a new animal up there, but the question is, will we see them more and more? Because they may be able to take advantage of this decrease in sea ice to get up there either earlier or in greater numbers. And one of the things that we're very concerned about in bowhead whales is that we'll have this vulnerability of calves. Bowhead whales calve in the lead system on their way to the eastern part of the Chukchi – I'm sorry, the eastern part of the Beaufort Sea from the Chukchi Sea. And if we start seeing more and more killer whales in that lead system or further to the north, there may be an impact on calf production. But what we're seeing right now with numbers, bowhead whale calf production is exploding. It's doing wonderful. And it's going to be interesting over time, though, to track if we start to suspect that there may be some of this this predation on these calves from killer whales.
We just have a moment, George. Any other species you consider a climate change winner here other than orcas?
Well, yes, actually, horned puffins, which are a subarctic species, moved north. And again, they were always seen at some level close to Barrow, but they started moving in numbers and bred on Cooper Island for the first time in 1986. They go into the Arctic seabird that I'm studying, black guillemots, and kill the chicks and also push the eggs out. So it's that same sort of thing that Cheryl's talking about with the orcas. There are species moving north now that the ice is melting, and they're impacting Arctic species.
Well, George Devoki and Cheryl Rosa, stand by. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the evolving Arctic, and we're going to take some more of your phone calls as well at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about climate change and how it is restructuring Arctic habitats and food chains with my guests, Cheryl Rosa, a wildlife veterinarian and biologist, and also deputy director of the United States Arctic Research Commission in Anchorage. George Devoki is an ornithologist and a director of Friends of Cooper Island, where he's been doing his field studies for some 40 years and has been seeing these changes firsthand. We're also taking calls from people who are seeing some of the changes up north firsthand, including Jim. Jim's calling from Petersburg, Alaska. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
Yeah, good morning. I'm much, much further south in Alaska, an entirely different climate. We have a different problem here, and that is that we are seeing a reduced snowpack at higher elevation. And the snowpack is not only, well, not so much critical for our supply of fresh water, but it's critical to keep our salmon streams going. And right now we're experiencing what we call an open winter, which is means literally no snow down here at sea level. And that's been part of a trend. People who have lived here for 60 years plus have commented that they've never seen conditions like this.
Jim,
so
thank you.
Not just an Arctic thing.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing that story. George Devoki, you mentioned earlier another issue we haven't really touched on much, the warmer seawater up north. What effect is that having on some of the species that live there?
Well, the main thing it's having an impact on now is the fact that the forage fish, and Arctic systems typically have very few species at every level of the food web, and polar cod or Arctic cod is the main fish that is consumed by all the upper trophic level predators in the Arctic. So that is moving the fish to deeper water where it's colder. And one of the other things, though, is that as it is warming, subarctic species are starting to come up. Now, that has caused some of the government agencies to have some interest in the potential of commercial fishing, but certainly yet they don't have that, and they don't have the data that lets them have that sort of fishery.
Cheryl Rosa, what are these changes doing to plants? We have been talking about animals a lot. What's happening with plant species?
Right. So we've got a couple of big differences. Plants on land, some of the things that have been seeing, some of the changes that have been seen have been an earlier start of green up. So when earlier snowmelt happens because of warmer temperatures, the plants get exposed to light earlier. Things warm up and they green up. You'll have an extended total growing season. And you'll have animals kind of trying to modify their habits potentially if they can according to these changes. And sometimes you'll get what's called a trophic mismatch. And that just basically means that you've got animals that we talked about a little bit earlier that are attuned to a certain time of green up and even attuned to the fact that you'll have like the maximum nutritional value in plants at a certain time. And that can be problematic, and not just for caribou, for things like shorebirds and nesting birds in the Arctic. They can do things like modify their nesting or their migration times. But the concept of animals that are generalists versus specialists is something that is important here, because animals that are specialists are probably going to be more impacted. And some of these studies the research that has been done is showing this. Because if you're not flexible, if you function in these very tight operational categories, in terms of temperature or when you have to show up to do your nesting, or you have to be there, for instance, and have your chicks maturing at a certain rate during an explosion of insect immersion, you won't do well if all of a sudden you're there a week late. These mosquitoes come out and you need to be eating them and you're not there, or you're not at the stage where you can take advantage of that, you're going to suffer the probably body condition impacts or potential mortality related to that.
George Devoki, before I let you go, I have to ask, you've been doing this for 40 years in the same spot, and you've seen all these changes. I mean, what is your hope? What is your plan for the future here?
Well, things are very different now on the island, because in the past I would band these black guillemot chicks, and I would see them come back as adults, and I have followed them for 33 years. Last summer, I banded around 70 guillemot chicks on the island, and I thought, okay, you'll come back and breed, and if you live for the next 30 years, you're going to live through a period of change in the Arctic that'll be even greater than what has happened over the past 30. My population is now down to 100 pairs. It used to be 225. It may not be able to make it through this bottleneck. And one of the issues is one of the things you talked about at the top of the hour, that the island itself, because the permafrost is melting, is now eroding rather rapidly, so that the island may actually be washed away by climate change.
Mm. George Devoki, an ornithologist and director of Friends of Cooper Island, holding fort very far up north. George, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you much.
Thanks also to Cheryl Rosa, who's a wildlife veterinarian and biologist, deputy director of the United States Arctic Research Commission in Anchorage. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You've probably had the experience where you go to the grocery store on an empty stomach. You've got a few items on your list, just a few, but you end up leaving with a cart full of junk food. Now, there's a new study that says your hunger for food might not just influence your choice in the grocery line, but even at the mall or when online shopping. Yes, the results were reported this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Let me bring on my next guest to explain why we might not want to shop while hungry. Norbert Schwartz is a co-author on that study. He's also a professor of psychology and marketing and director of the Dornsife Mind and Society Center at the University of Southern California. He joins us from a studio on campus there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
You tested this idea of hunger and motivation with an experiment using something fairly mundane, binder clips. Take us through the setup of the study.
Yes. Essentially, the participants were asked to test binder clips, which you know, find some good and useful, before or after they had lunch. In one of these studies, we waited at a student cafeteria on campus and asked people who were in line to get lunch or people who had just eaten to tell us about how good they found the binder clips, and then gave them an opportunity to take home binder clips that they would like. And those who had just eaten took much fewer binder clips than those who were still hungry and waiting for lunch.
Okay, so hold it. They got a chance to look at these binder clips and determine whether or not they were nice binder clips or not, but did that have anything to do with it? Did the quality of the binder clips actually matter?
No, in fact, they don't really like the binder clips. What happens is a different story. When you're hungry, you want to eat, and it puts getting food on your mind, but getting food requires a lot of steps along the way. You have to find food, you have to get food, you can't just eat it. And if you're in that mindset of wanting stuff, that spills over to other stuff, and you apply it to all kinds of stuff that you can get along the way. With one exception, when you're hungry, you like the food more, and you get more food, but you don't like the other stuff more. You just take it when you have a chance.
Interesting. So did the hungry people feel fulfillment from getting these binder clips? I want to make sure I understand this. Were they trying to displace their need for food by getting some sort of stuff, or was there something that made them feel like they needed just anything that they could get their hands on?
No, I think it's a much more mindless process. We're not really seeing that you're lusting for binder clips, right? So that's an unlikely response to have. And what's going on is more that you are really wanting food. And when we pursue goals, we don't just pursue the end state. There are lots of steps involved. And pursuing a goal increases the likelihood that any one of these steps comes to mind and that you enact it when you have a chance. So as a result, you're taking more binder clips or you're buying more non-food items that you cannot eat while it's on your mind to get stuff, but it's not a displacement of the desire to eat in that sense that you now find these things wonderful. They actually do not satisfy your motive at all. They don't feed you. Your hunger remains. So as a result, we find that people do not like that stuff more. They're just taking more of it. And it's a kind of a mindless spillover of the mindset you are in.
So you also examined the receipts of hungry shoppers. This wasn't just about binder clips, but you actually went out to the mall and you surveyed shoppers and you found some of the same behavior.
Exactly. So shoppers who are more hungry come out of the mall with more stuff. And we scanned their receipts and analyzed their receipts, and they're buying more things and they're spending more money. And the difference is relatively large, in the neighborhood of 60% more stuff.
So I can understand my emotions when I go to the store and I'm hungry, the grocery store. I see things on the shelves. I put them into the cart, of course. And I can imagine this happening when I go into a store and applying these same principles. But what about online shopping? I'm just sitting there with a mouse and a screen in front of me. Maybe my stomach's rumbling a little bit. Does it work for online shopping, too?
We haven't tested online shopping, but I'm quite confident that it will work for online shopping, in part because the constraints are even less. It's like an easier to engage behavior. You only have to click on it.
So what do you think it is in our mind that is exactly making this shift, that somehow or other this happens where we are clicking along or we're shopping and we're actually just really, really hungry?
Yep.
What's making this happen in our minds?
It is a variant of a very common thing. You're more likely to act on something the easier it comes to mind. So whatever is on your mind at a given moment exerts some influence on your behavior if you can apply it to the current situation. So if getting stuff is on your mind, it spills over to opportunities where you can take stuff. It is not as mindful as it may seem. It's a relatively automatic behavior, and you're unlikely to notice it.
Does this have to do with willpower at all? I mean, would people with a stronger willpower be able to fend this off?
No, your willpower would require that you say, I do not want to act on this. But you're very unlikely to even notice that you're acting on it. And willpower isn't very helpful when you don't know what you're doing.
I've found this myself. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking with Norbert Schwartz about a very fascinating study about what makes us want to just collect more stuff, buy more stuff, not just food, when we're hungry. If you want to call us, 844-724-8255. Michelle is calling from Long Island, New York. Hi there, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
We come from a Muslim family, and we fast during Ramadan for 30 days from sunrise to sunset. You know, no water, no food. And we know in our community, family, and friends that we should never go grocery shopping while we're fasting. We try to go after we break our fast because we know that, I know every time I walk into a grocery store, I just have to get one thing. I end up leaving with 20, 30 things because everything just looks so appealing because I'm starving.
Well, okay, so apply this to what our professor's talking about here. Does the same thing happen when you go clothes shopping during Ramadan, Michelle?
You know what? I think when you go clothes shopping during Ramadan, at least for me, I think we're so tired in our fast because of the lack of water and dehydration and everything. The only thing you're thinking of is food. But definitely online shopping, you're bored. You have nothing else to do. You can't eat, you know. So anything that feels productive, I think maybe, you know, you might end up doing. But for as far as grocery shopping, I know definitely, like, that's my whole life. I've known that as a fact, that when you're hungry, you definitely buy more food.
Michelle, thank you very much for sharing your story. It sounds to me, Norbert Schwartz, like she's a good case study for you here.
Absolutely. And she's absolutely describing the right thing. I mean, you're very likely to buy a lot of food and you will like that food. But what also happens along the way is that you'll pick up some non-food items and you don't even like them.
You know, there have been some studies that hormones can affect some of this stuff, some of our choices at the grocery store and at the mall. What do you know about that?
Yes, there is some evidence that, for example, hormones can influence both how much you buy, but also how choosy you are at a given point. And it is likely that those things also spill over into other domains. But we have not yet done that research. But it is very likely that once you have a desire, that all the steps along the way to satisfying that desire are also more likely to be enacted when you have a chance.
From the work that you've done, does it seem like all of the choices we make in some way or other have some underlying biological basis? I mean, are we doing things, as you suggested earlier, kind of mindlessly without even knowing it all the time?
Yeah, you're doing things mindlessly all the time. Not all of them will have biological reasons. Sometimes it just comes to mind because it's prompted by something that you do. You see something in the shop window as you walk by. You had some other conversations that put something on your mind. These contextual influences on behavior are very common, but they're not all biologically based.
Mm. Marketing is, of course, part of what you study. Many people might be listening to this wondering, how might companies use information like this to market products differently to us? It seems like this might be pretty important information if you're trying to sell certain kinds of stuff.
Yes, I mean, at this point, it suggests, for example, that people will actually buy more things when they're hungry. So maybe you don't want to be at the tail end of the food court where they're walking out after having eaten. Maybe you're selling more before they reach the food court, but again, I mean, we do not have the data for that, but it is conceivable that that's the case.
Is there a next thing along these lines that you're studying?
One could analyze the data of companies before and after food courts, and that's something we will be looking at.
Before and after the food court, another trip to the mall, perhaps. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Norbert Schwartz is a professor of psychology and marketing and director of the Dornsife Mind and Society Center at the University of Southern California. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And don't shop while you're hungry, for goodness sake. One last note for our listeners in New York City and the tri-state area. IRA will be hosting Science Friday's first ever live trivia event on Wednesday, May 13th. That's at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Find out more and get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. And good luck. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our Sci-Arts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. And Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can join our mailing list. If you like us, by all means, like us on Facebook and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. You can download iPhone and Android apps and listen and look on demand. And if you'd like to write us, you can do that too. It's Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can still email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.